You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, I'm Lionel Burney, and I'm with Daniel Free.
Hello, Lionel.
Hello, Daniel.
Where's Richard today? Where is the buffalo?
The buffalo is on secondment to the Ardennes. He's at Flèche Wallonne today with Orla Chenoui, and we'll hear from them in the third part of today's podcast, so it won't be a buffalo-free zone.
No, but we're still feeling slightly bereft. Always do, without his firm guiding hand. No?
Well, yeah, we are. I mean, I'm clueless. No idea what to do. Just ramble through until we can hand over. Madison-style, hand-sling Richard and Orla in at the end. On that note, should we kick off with what's been going on in the world of cycling this week? It's been a busy time for the racing. The World Tour race at the weekend was the Amstel Gold Race. The men's race came down to a showdown between Philippe Gilbert and Michał Kwiatkowski at the finish. We'll talk about that in the first part of this week's podcast. Gilbert won it. Michael Albertini took third place ahead of Nathan Haas. But we found out after the race that Philippe Gilbert is out of Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège and probably the Giro d'Italia as well, with an injured kidney that he sustained in a crash during the race. That means that Quickstep are without both Gilbert and Julian Alaphilippe for Liège-Bastogne-Liège on Sunday, but they do still have Dan Martin as one of the sort of people on the long list of favourites for the final spring classic on Sunday. The women's Amstel Gold was won by Anna van der Breggen ahead of Lizzie Deignan. Much more racing going on the men's side of the calendar. Brabantse Pijl was won by Sonny Colbrelli ahead of last year's winner Petr Vakoc. The French Cup series of races sort of reached a bit of a spring peak with four races in quick succession. There was Paris Camembert won by Nasser Bouhanni, the Grand Prix d'Annam won by Arnaud Démare. So big wins there for, well, medium-sized wins there for France's two big sprinters. And then
a big bit of cheese. Big bits of cheese, napalm. You still get your weight, don't you? Still get your weight in Camembert for winning Paris Camembert, which is actually a pretty difficult race for a sprinter to win. So it was pretty impressive by Bouhanni, who is now the proud, delighted owner, I'm sure, of about 63 kilos of Camembert.
Yeah, two big wheels of Camembert, perhaps. Could construct some kind of cheese bike out of it. But my mind's drifting already. It's thoughts of a cheese bike. That sounds terrific. The other two races at the weekend were in Brittany, the Tour du Finistère and Trobriand, both won by French army riders, the Armée de Terre team. Officially, all the riders are soldiers. Unofficially, they're sort of nominally soldiers, I think. But Julien Loubet won on Saturday at the Tour du Finistère. And on Monday, Damien Godin, once fifth in Paris-Roubaix, took a big win there. For the second year in a row, Laurent Pichon was the best Breton, and he won a pig, a live pig. Not sure the riders actually take the live pigs away with them after Trobriand, but between the pig at Trobriand and the cheese at Paris Camembert, you've got yourself quite a nice baguette, haven't you? Anyway.
What a fantastic competition the French Cup is. You know, all this talk over the past few years of the World Tour not really working as a series of races, but you know, I like the sound of a series where you can win a pig one week and, 60-odd kilos of Camembert on a Wednesday and a pig on a Saturday or a Sunday.
Should clarify, though, you've got to be Breton to win the pig, unfortunately. It's not available to everyone. Just while talking Trobriand, if that race caught your eye, you managed to see the highlights on Eurosport or watched it on the Eurosport player, friends of the podcast can listen to a short episode kind of explaining a bit of the history and background and culture and character of that race. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. And yeah, we called it the Hipsters Classic, the sort of race that would appeal to you, Daniel, kind of unheralded, a bit quirky, the sort of Shoreditch cafe of races.
We're still waiting, aren't we, Lionel, for, you have to remind me of the name that the organisers, or the name that's used locally to describe the sort of dirt race. It begins with an R, doesn't it?
Ribin in singular.
Ribin, yeah.
Ribinu as a collection of off-road tracks, yeah.
We're still waiting for them to make an appearance on the Tour de France route, aren't we? We think that is probably going to happen at some point in the fairly near future.
Well, local rumours last year in Brittany were that it would be 2018 when the Tour starts in West France and heads north If it heads up into Brittany, there's a possibility. I hope so. Anyway, it was a fantastic race to go and watch. But yeah, if you want to find out more about the Tour Brulil, have a listen to the Friends of the Podcast bonus episode. On with the news, because we've still got a bit more to talk about. The Tour of the Alps. I mean, Daniel, this is the beginning of the end. Rebranding the Giro del Trentino as a Tour of the Alps. I'm not a fan of this at all. In fact, I'd quite like to boycott any mentions of the race, but I won't. Michele Scarponi won the opening stage for Astana. It's looking like he may well be Astana's leader for the Giro if Fabio Aru is unfit. Stage 2 was shortened because of snow. Rowan Dennis won that ahead of Thibaut Pinot, who currently leads as we talk. The race finishes on Friday. Big build-up for the Giro d'Italia, of course. Pinot, Geraint Thomas, Scarponi and so on, all in the mix there. You may want to tune out a bit here, Daniel, talk about the indoor cycling, the World Track Championships in Hong Kong. Australia had a very good week, topping the medal table with 11. Three of them were gold. The highlights of the racing were probably at Scotland's Katie Archibald winning the Omnium after a very close points race battle with Kirsten Wild and Amy Cure. The Welsh rider Eleanor Barker won Britain's other gold in the points race, and she also won a silver in the scratch and a silver in the first women's Madison held at a World Championships when she partnered Emily Nelson. Christina Vogel won both the sprint and the Keirin, and on the men's side, the French sprinter François Pervis won the kilometre time trial for the fourth time. Cameron Meyer won another rainbow jersey on his comeback to racing in the points race. Probably the most popular winner of the week was Aziz Alhazni Awang, who won his first world title in the Keirin. He's had several silver and bronze medals over the years. You may remember he got the splinter through his leg at Manchester in a World Cup meeting in 2011. Always races with a smile on his face. Well, you know, afterwards. Often does a wheelie over the line, as he did in Hong Kong. So a very popular winner there. And finally, a little bit of Giro d'Italia news. They're bringing back the Ciclamino jersey. I won't call it the purple jersey. That probably offend all the Italophiles out there.
Cyclamen, isn't it, Lionel? Cyclamen is the actual, which is a fruit. Am I right? It's a type of plum?
It's a plant, isn't it? It's got purple leaves, yeah.
Is it not a plum? Is it not a type of plum?
No, I don't think it is. Is it? It's, we'll have to do a bit of Googling here. I'm not really any kind of botanist. You've got the wrong person.
Oh, you're right. No, it's a flower. It's a flower.
It's a flower. I know it's got purple leaves or cyclamen leaves.
But kind of a plum colour, isn't it?
It is a plum colour, and it's going to be the jersey for the points competition. Since 2010, they've had a red jersey for the points competition at the Giro, but this is a traditional move going back to cyclamen or purple. So as it's traditional, I'm fully behind it.
And apparently the cyclamen is the flower of deep love, Lionel.
Wow!
So, wow! Who's the most amorous rider in the peloton? Eros Capecchi would be a good winner of the Maglia Ciclamino, wouldn't he?
He would indeed.
But I mean, think he's gonna. He's probably gonna ride the Giro. He moved to. He is riding for Quickstep Floors this year, but he's more of a domestique. Very unlikely to win the points jersey, I would suggest.
No, it will. We shall follow that when we get to the Giro, coming up very quickly now, isn't it? Only a couple of weeks away. Daniel will
16 days, Lionel. Oh. 16 days, apparently.
Are you crossing the days off on your wall?
I read yesterday, you mentioned there that Fabio Aru has, he's trying a desperate attempt to heal his knee injury in time to start the Giro, which of course starts in Sardinia, his home island. I have visions of him appearing. You remember Pantani appeared in 2000. There'd been no news of Pantani for weeks and weeks or even months before the 2000 Giro. And then he appeared in very ceremonial or ceremonious fashion for the papal blessing in the Vatican. That Giro started in Rome, and it was a moment of fantastic theatre. And actually, one of the moments I was thinking when we were making our Giro special a couple of weeks ago, one of the moments which really added to the mystique of Pantani, that was very typical of Pantani, what he did that year.
Good that you mention our Giro special. That will be out on Friday, April the 28th. I think that's 1 week before the Giro starts, so that's coming up soon. Loosely titled Giro 100, I think we're calling that, or Giro 100. It's the 100th edition of the Giro. It's not a review of the 100-year history of the race. It's more of an eclectic look at what makes the Giro so special and why we're looking forward to going back there to cover it daily this year. So that will be the next Friends of the Podcast special out next week. But we better get on with talking about the Spring Classics, Daniel, because they haven't concluded yet. We've had the Amstel Gold Race in the Netherlands at the weekend, and I was very uncomplimentary about the race as it was unfolding when we were swapping messages about the entertainment factor. From about 100 kilometers to go to 50 kilometers to go, it looked like the same old, but it really reignited, didn't it? 45 odd kilometers from the finish. Philippe Gilbert, again, the architect, forcing clear a very strong move of riders. His heart may have sunk a little to see that two Sky riders were in there, particularly as one of them was Kwiatkowski, who's won Strada Bianca and Milan-San Remo already this season. And it ended up being a shootout between two of the men of the spring, with only Greg Van Avermaet, the other man of the spring, missing.
Yeah, you talked about the entertainment factor, Lionel. I mean, the one thing in Amstel's favour and that is not recognised, acknowledged enough, is that Amstel is a very different kind of race. I mean, so the roads are so narrow, so many twists and turns. It really does. It's a different kind of test. And it's also this nice melting point or melting pot between the, which comes between the Cobbled Classics and the Ardennes Classics. And you do get the odd rider like Greg Van Avermaet, who considers himself and turns out to be versatile enough to have a go at both of them. And I thought that made for an interesting spectacle. We talked about the route change last week. I think I got it pretty much completely wrong. I got one thing right about the route change. That was the Coburg.
It wasn't going to be the
decisive climb. It wasn't going to be the final climb. And we were both very pleased about that, because we've been whining for years about the three races that come this week, Amstel, Flesch and Liège, being too similar, all pretty much finishing on top of hills. And this year it was quite different. And that really sort of threw all the balls up in the air. I think it really muddled a few minds. People lost their bearings, lost their reference points. And that made it very interesting. No one really knew where the decisive action was going to come. The riders had to take sort of snap decisions. It turned out that the really decisive move came with about 38 kilometers to go on the Kreuzberg. Not to be confused with the Kreuzberg that sometimes features in the Tour of Flanders, different Kreuzberg. And six riders, Henao, Gilbert, Albasini, made their move. And I think what was very impressive there after was Kwiatkowski actually took a big risk, I thought, coming across to that group, because, you know, that's a sort of a cardinal sin in the tactical playbook, that if you attack to get across to a group in which you already have a teammate, you risk bringing riders across, and you really have to be sure that you're strong enough to go away fast enough not to bring anyone. And Kwiatkowski pulled that off, and consequently Sky had a numerical advantage in the front group. But Gilbert and Kwiatkowski were really clearly stronger than the rest, weren't they? And they went well. They really forced the pace with about 6 kilometers to go on the final climb, the Bemelerberg. And and then it set up an interesting sprint, because both fast riders, and Kwiatkowski tried to do what he did at Milan-San Remo. We talked for a while at San Remo, after San Remo, about this tactic of sort of laying off. He laid off Sagan so that he got a run up to come into Sagan's slipstream and then go round him. He tried that again, but he probably went from slightly too far out, and Gilbert is just so strong at the moment that he can sustain a sprint for 200, 300, 400 metres. And that's what he did, and came around fairly easily at the end.
Yeah, it's a track technique, isn't it, laying off like that? I mean, not that we've never seen it on the road before, of course we have, but giving himself that little bubble where he can gain momentum, then sustain momentum, hopefully, and have enough to come past Gilbert. But Gilbert was incredibly strong and just looked really confident that he would have enough. There was a moment where it looked like maybe it was slipping away from him in that sprint, but incredibly impressive riding by Gilbert, and to take the race on from so far out, again, not as far out as he took the Tour of Flanders on, of course, but not knowing the course and the impact of the course. I mean, it's one of the things that I was trying to work out once the race had finished was How familiar would they have been with, you know, what was coming up, and making that calculation of, have I got enough to press this hard this early? And you, in the sort of final analysis, you wonder, was it just purely the fact that they've changed the course that made the race unpredictable, made it that something, a move like this could flourish? Or was it just a combination of climbs and roads and what have you? You know, just saying, well done, they've made a classic course. Perhaps they haven't. Perhaps it was just the fact that it was different to previous years, and it forced the riders to ride differently, and it rewarded the tremendous risks that Gilbert made.
Yeah, and we've talked quite a few times, Lionel, in the last few months about this kind of conditioning, this sort of historical conditioning that takes place of the peloton, that because Liège-Bastogne-Liège has generally suited a certain type of rider, then that same certain type of rider automatically thinks that it's going to suit them now. And the race kind of is almost socially, historically conditioned to go a certain way. These races with very well-established courses. And, you know, we talked about exceptions to that in the last few months. World Championships are always an exception to that because, you know, teams arrive the week of the race and, you know, they've done one or two recces, but they don't really know how it's all going to pan out. And consequently, you can get strange mixes of riders competing for the victory. You might get guys who you think of more as sprinters and guys you think of more as climbers. I mentioned Strade Bianche in this vein a few weeks ago, because that's a route that's changed around a little bit since that race's inception, well, just over 10 years ago, or 10 years ago. And again, it's a race where you might see Grand Tour riders competing against sort of punchy type riders. And, you know, it was interesting in that considering that, it was interesting to see Van Avermaet at the front and riding so well. Again, because, you know, no one on this route, there was no proof. There was no evidence to suggest historical evidence that he wouldn't be able to compete on this kind of route, as there would have been with the Kooiberg. If the race was still finished on the Kooiberg, then you would presume Van Avermaet would probably have known in advance that this wasn't his kind of race, and not maybe even have competed. But I think that is, well, it's the beauty of this new route, and it's the beauty of Amstel in a way.
It is, yeah. And I mean, when you look at the way the groups came together, the front group had, you know, really diverse riders in it. Michael Abbasini is a good stage racer. He does very well. He won recently in Spain, hasn't he? At the Basque Country, did he win a stage there? Henao is, you would think of more of a sort of stage race rider. And then having Rojas in there as well, Jose Joaquin Rojas of Movistar, who was there as very much the policeman for Alejandro Valverde, who was the other rider who really missed out. And probably that was the only kind of shot that they had of bringing it back in, was when Valverde was trying to drive it and get a bit of collaboration going to bring the break in. I think, you know, the likes of Michael Matthews and Sonny Colbrelli would have wanted it to all come back together again for a sprint as well. But, you know, it was obviously very hard to chase in. And we've seen on Amstel Gold in the past how it all kind of comes back together again. It seems to just always go away, come back together, go away, come back together, until finally somebody snaps the elastic. Or in recent years, we've seen quite big groups coming to the line. And this was completely different. It went away and it stuck.
Yeah, and again, Lionel, as we keep mentioning, or we've mentioned on numerous occasions after the classics, that the key factor was the lack of hesitation. Again, those riders at the front, Henao, Gilbert, Albasini, when they got together, they were very aware of the danger of Valverde, Felline, Van Avermaet and Wellens coming back, and they worked incredibly harmoniously until that final climb with 6 kilometres to go. I mean, just on Gilbert as well, I mean, it's obviously been an extraordinary spring for him. Bears pointing out as well that he had we talked about his injuries, but he had that terrible crash with 140 kilometres to go. It was interesting just reading Tom Steele's, the Quickstep Floors director sportif, his comments after the race. He said that probably only about five riders would have got up and carried on after a crash like that. So, you know, Gilbert, it's something we've maybe forgotten about in recent years because we've seen Gilbert earning a lot of money for BMC, living in Monaco, not perhaps just from the outside, looking as motivated as he had maybe in his FDJ days or his Lotto days. And we've thought that maybe, you know, he's not the fighter, he's not the combative rider that he once had been, but that is very much one of his characteristics, or it certainly has been for a lot of his career.
Yeah, I mean, since Dwars Door Vlaanderen coming up for a month ago, his average finishing position must be about 1.5. I mean, he's more or less won or finished second. Well, in fact, he has won or finished second in everything except Brabantsepil, where he was 15th. But that is the end of his spring campaign. And in many ways, that opens up Liège-Bastogne-Liège on Sunday. Or perhaps it closes it down. We'll discuss that in the next part.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the podcast all season. We're very grateful to them for their support, and our listeners should be very grateful to the fact that if you go to the Science in Sport website, which is scienceinsport.com, and if you buy any of their products and enter the code CPOD20, that's CPOD20, when you check out, you'll get 20% off your order. That doesn't work in conjunction with any other orders though, but yeah, CPOD20 at scienceinsport.com for a 20% discount on gels, bars and powders and all that kind of thing. Daniel, the final spring classic of the season, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, there's a sense that everything is building towards it and that it should be the magnificent finale. But it's a race that's not really captured my imagination in the last few years. Is that a feeling you have, or is that really unfair and dour of me?
I think the problem that, well, one big problem that Liège has had over the last 15 to, well, probably 20 years now has been, well, it's a race that's renowned and well known everywhere for its awesome difficulty, and I think it looks slightly lighter and slightly easier this year in terms of the climbing, but it is an incredibly difficult race, and it has generally been won by a majority of riders who have subsequently been exposed for doping, you know, particularly between 2000 and 2010 you had the likes of Alexander Vinokourov, Tyler Hamilton, Alejandro Valverde himself, and that is certainly, I think, you know, you used to watch Liège as the ultimate test of sort of one day endurance with all that climbing, and because it was so difficult, it did tend to bring riders who were cheating to the fore, unfortunately, and as far as the racing is concerned, I mean, I think since probably, I think we all probably acknowledge that the doping situation is more under control these days. I think the riders have found it more difficult, and they have been intimidated by the route a lot of the time, and they've ridden pretty defensively. And we've seen, you know, a climb like La Redoute, for example, which comes, is it about 35 kilometres from the finish? I'll just check that. Which is really the iconic climb of Liège-Bastogne-Liège, but for a long time now, it has really had no significant impact on the outcome. No one is willing to chance their arm, or none of the big hitters are really willing to chance their arm from that far out. And we've seen all of the exciting or decisive action come on the, well, one of the last two or three climbs. So this year, that's the Rochefort-Franc, the Saint-Nicolas, or the final rise to Anse. And yeah, so it's been a case of wait and see, really, until the very last few kilometres.
Yeah, it's interesting the point you make about it being hard. Maybe it is too hard. And certainly the final rise up to the line does give every incentive to wait and basically make your final move there. So not as much incentive once a group's gone clear, and once it's much more of a sort of war of attrition, isn't it, rather than you know, you don't particularly see an explosive move from a long way out. I think really, would it be right in saying the last one was Andy Schleck in 2009, which was, you know, an incredible performance, where he went from a fair way out and won on his own.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you have to go back a long way to find a Liège that was won by a decisive move on La Redoute. I think one of the last ones was, well, I think Frank Vandenbroek in 1999, he didn't, that wasn't his winning move, but certainly there was a real, a really thrilling battle with Michele Bartoli on La Redoute, which then set up the winning move, which came later on the San Nicolas. But Bartoli himself in 97 made a big move on La Redoute, but we've not really seen that for a long time.
So with a few of the climbs having come out of the route, it does look a little bit lighter on categorised climbs, but of course we know from that region it's twisty, turny, up and down. You know, there's a lot of hidden climbing in the route as well. Just because something isn't called the Côte to something doesn't mean it's not going uphill. So it may well be that it's a slightly different race this year, but we're going to expect the same sorts of people up at the front as we saw on Sunday at Amstel Gold, aren't we? Albeit bar Philippe Gilbert, but Kwiatkowski for Sky in the absence of Wout Poels, who won for Sky last year. He is still out of action. But Kwiatkowski, Alessandro Valverde, Rui Costa maybe, Michael Albasini, who was second at Liège-Bastogne-Liège last year and rode very well at the weekend in Amstel. Warren Barguil, who was sort of there or thereabouts-ish, wasn't he, on Sunday and did well at Liège last year. I mean, the long list is fairly long, but really when it comes down to it, current form is going to be incredibly important, isn't it? So is it possible to look past the likes of Kwiatkowski and Valverde possibly?
Well, I'm just looking at the betting line also. Valverde is the favourite, then followed by Daniel Martin, then Kwiatkowski, Rui Costa, Tom Dumoulin, Sergio Henao. And you've got a few guys in there as well who have been pretty quiet. I mean, that's another characteristic of the Ardennes Classics. Often it's riders who have not been doing a lot of racing in the previous few weeks. Obviously in the Cobbled Classics you have this long build-up of several weeks, so you really get a good feel before the Tour of Flanders of who's going well, who's not. I mean, the key, I suppose, litmus test for Liège is Flèche Wallonne, which will take place today, but a very different race as well in a lot of ways, an awful lot shorter, less difficult, and really a test of climbing on the Mur de Huy. And Liège is different, and it's going to be, I think it will be even more different, and those differences between Liège and Flèche will be accentuated by the weather, because I think it's going to be pretty nasty at the weekend. That's certainly the forecast. If that is the case, I think the real hard men will thrive. So I'm looking at Valverde, Dan Martin, I think will go well in the cold or wet. And I also think Rui Costa will go really well. If you remember the World Championship in Florence that he won in 2013, where he actually beat Valverde. That was a pretty nasty day. And he's not an explosive rider. He's not someone who will probably do particularly well in Flèche Wallonne, but certainly a potential winner of Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And I think he's been at altitude the last couple of weeks. He's obviously building up to the Giro. Rigoberto Urán, another one. We've talked about how much Cannondale need a result. They weren't particularly prominent in Amstel at the weekend, but hopefully it will go better for them at the weekend. And then Adam Yates as well, you would think, has all of the attributes to be very competitive in Liège.
Yeah, you mentioned Cannondale there. I mean, while they didn't make the front split, they did have a lot of numbers at the front of that second group. Now, probably slightly misleading, because having missed it, the onus was on them to do some chasing, but they certainly had people who were there. So you know, maybe they will figure at the weekend. But we are talking on the morning of Flèche Wallonne. We've got Richard and Orla out in Belgium, so they'll update us on this afternoon's race. Messing with the space-time continuum here, getting very confused. But we perhaps talk about some of the other.
Well, can I just mention
any of the other cycling news
on Flèche Wallonne and on Liège as well, Lionel? I'd like to just tip my hat to Nathan Haas, who not only did he ride brilliantly for Dimension Data in Amstel Gold, but he also came up with the best analogy that any cyclist has produced for several years, I think, when he described Fleshwell On this week as being like an ice sculpture. And his explanation for this was that the last pick of the ice, where you can either make something really beautiful at the end or the whole thing. Oh, sorry. The Mudahoy is the last pick of the ice where you can either make something really beautiful at the end or the whole thing collapses. I thought that was brilliant. That was up there with them. And I'm not going to fully explain this now, but in the pantheon of great cycling analogies, that was up there with Mark Cavendish has produced a few crackers over the years, but the one about doping or not doping being like having a cat or not having a cat. But maybe we'll explain that in full, if I haven't already in the past, in a future podcast.
So you either have a cat or you don't have a cat.
It's pretty much that. It was slightly more elaborate. He dragged it out a little bit more, but it was pretty much.
Well, we'll listen out for that when Cavendish is back in action, perhaps, which may be some time, seeing as he has glandular fever or mononucleosis, as it's more commonly known in America, I think. But just before we hand over to Richard and Orla at the Mudahoy, which I imagine is where they'll be, at least I hope that's where they've got to. Anything else from the recent cycling news that catches your eye? I mean, the return of the purple jersey at the Giro, or the rebranding of the Giro del Trentino as the Tour of the Alps. I mean, these are things that must get you very agitated.
Oh, they get me very exercise lineup. I mean, the Tour of the Alps, it looks like a great concept, and I'm glad that that's there. I'm obviously glad that that race has been, well, saved or is going to get a new lease of life by virtue of this association with Austria and Sud Tirol, because the race used to be confined to the Trentino region of Italy, and it's now a race that's going to visit two countries. So it's going to be based in Austria and Italy. But yeah, the Tour of the Alps, a fantastic opportunity to actually refer to the Dolomites, because it's one of the few races. Often the erstwhile Giro del Trentino had more stages in the Dolomites than the Giro itself. This year's race also has several stages in the Dolomites, but yeah, they've decided to call it the Tour of the Alps.
This really isn't helping me, is it? When the Tour of the Alps actually takes place in the Dolomites, and there's no such thing as a Tour of the Dolomites. I mean,
we're going to have a refresher, aren't we? In May, we're going to have to refresh, of course. Yes.
Well, people can do their homework ahead of the Giro and listen back to our Kilometre Zero on the Dolomites from last year's Giro. If you go to the website, thecyclingpodcast.com, you'll have to scroll back through the latest episodes all the way back to last May and the Kilometre Zero series we did. But we made one on the Dolomites where you basically explained to me what was and what wasn't a Dolomite as we went round Italy.
I explained the inexplicable, didn't I? And other news, Lionel, you mentioned the Ciclamino jersey, which we touched on earlier in the podcast. Good to see it back. It was something that was very, well, typical and unique to the Giro. I would like to see the Intergiro come back as a competition. The Intergiro was a sort of general classification, but the finish line every day was at an arbitrary point somewhere along the route. So what that did was mean that it was essentially a jersey rewarding breakaways and breakaway artists. And I thought that was also very unique to the Giro, and it was good fun, I used to think.
Yeah, was it not roughly halfway through the stage they would have a halfway finish line, and the GC times were taken at that point? So if you were in a break that was 4 minutes up the road, you obviously gained 4 minutes in the Intergiro. Kind of confusing but charming in its own way, the Giro. With they've had several of these wacky competitions over the years, haven't they? They're probably the last to let go of the team points classification as well, the Giro d'Italia, wasn't it? Where basically like the points competition, but run for teams, as well as the teams competition run on time. There were an awful lot of strange classifications in the Giro. Not sure all of them added to the spectacle of the race, really.
But since we've established that Cyclamen is the flower of deep love, it would actually be fun, or would have been fun, certainly at different points in the Giro's past, if they had had a deep love jersey. I think Mario Cipollini, just on that, I think he did win the Ciclamino jersey a few times, didn't he? Probably as the
Yeah, well, or maybe a modern contender, given the Shark's Tale excerpts that you were reading during last year's Giro. Some of them were a little bit racy. Vincenzo Nibali might be in the mix, but we'll probably have to leave the thoughts of the Giro for another couple of weeks, because although it is just on the horizon, it's not quite here yet. We've still got the rest of the Ardennes Classics to go, and we should probably throw over to Richard and Orla in Huy. So thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Lionel.
Hey, it's Hannah Barnes, rider for Canyon-SRAM Racing Team, and you're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA. My favourite ride was this year on New Year's Day. We rode for 5 hours to the top of this 20k climb and back down, and Mar de Déu du Delmont, it's called. The weather was really amazing. I love RAFA because they ask us for feedback on items, and they always are curious in what we think of the products, and they spend a lot of time making us comfortable and, yeah, just helping us enjoy training and racing.
The RAFA Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much indeed to RAFA for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. Very grateful to them. A little reminder, I'm doing an event next Thursday evening at the RAFA Cafe in Manchester with Hannah Barnes of Canyon-SRAM and one of her teammates as well. So come along to that in Manchester. Go to rafa.cc for information. I think it's rafa.cc events, and you'll find the details of that event at the Manchester Cafe, the RAFA Cafe in Manchester. Thank you very much, Lionel and Daniel, for your efforts earlier in the podcast, reflecting on the Amstel Gold Race. So you head to Liège-Bastogne-Liège. I am on the Mur de Huy with Orla Shinoui. I'm Richard Moore, by the way, and I'm with Orla Shinoui. Hello, Orla.
Hello, that was a nice rhyme on the Mur de Huy with Orla Shinoui. Beautiful.
Like it. Orla, we're just actually watching the men crest the top of the climb here for the first time. A lot of Movistar riders in front. Rory Sutherland there. Good effort by him to stay at the front. Makes you appreciate that they perhaps haven't gone up there flat out at the stage. The first of three ascents of the Mur de Huy. There's a break a little bit off the front, but obviously Movistar working hard for Alejandro Valverde to try and win his fifth race. A lot of riders sitting up, taking off wind jackets and stuff. It's very cold, sunny but very cold day. Difficult day to dress for.
Yeah, I just saw Mikhail Kwiatkowski and Hinault both sitting up, taking off their outer layer of garments, and bang in the middle of that peloton, so well enough placed. I think they'll be feeling fairly comfortable. Didn't see much of a strong presence teammate-wise around them, but yeah, as you say, Movistar, as we would have expected, trying to boss this race once again.
And it's condensed a little bit this year, the three climbs of the Mur de Huy all coming pretty late on in the race. Don't know how that will change things, if at all. Orla, we watched earlier on the women's race, and we've recorded a lot of stuff from that, and we've got a lot of interviews from there for the Cycling Podcast Femina, which will be out next week. Anna van der Breggen, the winner, will be in that. She was a very impressive winner for the third time in a row, attacked before the climb, and for the second women's World Tour event in a row, it was a Bulls Domus 1-2 with van der Breggen first and Lizzie Deignan second. You spoke to both of them.
I did, and both, as you'd imagine, delighted, partly as well, not just the win, but because the team have come under quite a bit of scrutiny this season after a very dominant season last year. They haven't really had the results by their standards. I mean, Lizzie Deignan still finished in the podium in Strade Bianche, but they haven't dominated in the same way. They've had a lot of illness, a bit of bad luck. And so they are relieved, I think, as much as anything else, that it's all coming together when it should be. These are their home races. The Ardennes Classics are really when they wanted to be showing off to their sponsors. That's exactly what they've done. And they're looking really strong. I mean, Lizzie as well as Anna, really, given the recovery that she's had to make from not just illness, but everything that's happened since Rio, and the readjustment she's had to make, I guess, to her confidence levels and momentum and everything that comes with that. That's very important, really, when it comes to performance on the bike. So both those women, very happy and very relieved. And yeah, they put on a fantastic race. It went exactly according to their plan. There was attack after attack. It was looked to be really dynamic from what we could follow on Twitter, because alas, there was no screen showing the race here at the finish line. But it seemed to be a very attacking race. And yet they managed to pull it back have the bunch together for the penultimate climb, which is exactly what they wanted to do. Van der Breggen had the legs, went for it, and no one could keep up with her. It was a brilliant display from her.
He did very well to stay focused there, Orla, while there were a couple of Aqua Blue riders going through off the back. Irish team, of course. only joking.
Do one.
Listen, you mentioned Lizzie Deignan. You spoke to her at the finish. Here she is, Lizzie Deignan.
Lizzie, congratulations. That must be an incredible feeling after, I guess, a difficult start to the season.
Yeah, it's been a hard road to get here. You know, a lot of times I thought I might as well just write off the spring because I just haven't been able to train. So I've obviously done half trained, but obviously missed a couple of intervals that I'd like to do before racing into a climb like this. But yeah, delighted.
And a 1-2 again for you and Anna. Was that the plan at the start of the day, I guess, if everything went according to plan?
Yeah, it was, well, not a particular plan for it to be Anna 1 and me 2 or, you know, whatever happened. But we wanted to be with 2 over that final, not this one, the other one, and then play the game. And I put in an attack first and then Anna did. And I guess once Cassio chased me down, she just didn't have the legs anymore to chase Anna. So an easy ride into the finish for me.
A lot of questions have been asked of the team at the start of the season. It must make it extra sweet now to have this double victory from Amstel Gold and today.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're used to it. We're used to doubters and criticism and all the rest. But I think I've said before, you have to keep your head down and keep working hard. And we always knew that this was the most important week for us. I mean, if you look on the side, it's all Orange Bowls rental. So as long as the sponsors are happy, then that's what it's all about, really.
Congratulations. Thanks, Lizzie.
Alejandro Valverde qui regarde vers le ciel. Cinquième victoire, quatrième succès consécutif. Et 11 ans après sa première victoire en 2006, il vient glaner un huitième succès dans les Ardennes. Formidable coureur, 37 ans dans quelques jours seulement. Et aujourd'hui, ici, au sommet du chemin des Chapelles, au sommet du mur de Wii, c'est la consécration. Il embrasse la caméra. Il avait embrassé le monde entier, le champion murcien, dans les bras de Jean-Michel Monnet, organisateur de ces Ardennes et de tout le staff d'Amaury Sport en organisation. Alejandro Valverde pour la cinquième victoire de sa carrière ici à la Flèche Wallonne.
Et merci, merci, public.
We heard there from Lizzie Deignan. We're now back at the top of the Mur de Huy. I think we were earlier, actually. And we've just watched, I just feel like I've experienced deja vu.
Yeah.
We watched Alejandro Valverde win once again, fourth time in a row, fifth time in total, and very easily. I mean, that's easy to say. I noticed our colleague Lionel tweeting from his sofa that this race needs a bit of a shake-up. Whether we'd be saying that if, you know, it wasn't the same winner every year, I don't know. But when a race is won, there is a formulaic sort of quality to it, isn't there, with especially the way it's been ridden and won the last few years.
And they did change the parkour. And to be fair to Valverde, it was anybody's race up until the last kilometre, really. He just had the best kick on the day. But all the favourites were right up there. And I thought it was very exciting in that sense. Although, you know, when you look in hindsight and you look at the results list, you think, well, that looked fairly inevitable and a little bit dull. But actually, the racing on the road, because you had all the favourites up there towards the end, mano a mano, I thought it was a really exciting finish, actually.
Well, it is exciting. It is exciting to watch. Bob Jungels off the front. I mean, quick step strategy out the window, really, with Philippe Gilbert missing and also Julien Alaphilippe. We were talking a couple of weeks ago about them having three leaders in this race. In the end, they had one, Dan Martin. But Bob Jungels was a bit of a wild card for them. And he was off the front. And, you know, such a good time trial, such a strong rider. He needed a little bit more at the bottom of the climb. He had about 25 seconds. He needed a bit more than that. Well, he probably needed quite a bit more than that. But, you know, there was an element of doubt there, I suppose, a few kilometres from the last time up the Mur de Huy, just because he is such a strong rider. And a very, very stylish rider to watch as well. Very classy on a bike, isn't he? Well, at the finish, I mean, I was very impressed by David Godu, the young Frenchman who's ridden extremely well the last few weeks. 20 years old, first year pro, won the Tour de l'Avenir last year. To see him up at the finish there, and he was the guy that initiated the Valverde attack. He kind of set Valverde up for it, it has to be said. But it was just a matter of time until Valverde jumped. But Godu was impressive. Just after the finish line, I caught up with Michael Woods, Rusty Woods, the Canadian on the Cannondale team. It's a race that suits him. He was up near the front. He was impressed by Godu. Here's what Michael Woods had to say. Michael, strong race. I mean, this is a race that you like and that suits you. How did the finale play out there?
I played it really well. The guys gave me an amazing lead out, but I tried to get to the front and just respond to the moves. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to respond when Valverde went and kind of blew up, but I mean, not a bad performance.
I mean, the way the race sort of unfolded there, young David Godu, I don't know how much you know about him. He's first year pro, and he was the guy that was the first to move there.
Yeah, he attacked and was super impressive. That kind of ignited everything. Really impressive move.
So you happy today with the form is good? You had Rigoberto around up there as well today.
Yeah, I hate to make excuses, but I've been sick all week, and really, I was hoping for a better performance for sure. But it was still good.
All for Liège-Bastogne-Liège on Sunday now?
You know it. Yeah.
Optimistic, confident?
For sure. Yeah, hopefully I can be a bit healthier and be good to go.
Great. Good luck. Thanks a lot. That was Michael. He was very reluctant to make any excuses, but has been a little bit unwell. Orla, as I finished that interview, I spotted you speaking to Michał Kwiatkowski, the Team Sky rider.
Who similarly was reluctant to make excuses and said that Valverde was simply the best rider on the day. He said he almost spoke as if it was a bit of an inevitability as well, that Valverde was obviously going to be the man to beat. He was happy with Team Sky's performance. He was happy with his performance. Looking ahead already to Sunday, here's what he had to say.
The boys did an amazing job in the end of the race. You know, I've seen many people on the knees, and just my teammates were perfect, you know. Diego Rosa was up there leading out Aston Moore, and Johnny Moscon was chasing, you know, above jungles all the way from second last climb. So I think we should be happy, you know. And I mean, Alejandro is amazing in such a final, and it's hard to beat him, but we tried and we have to be happy with that.
Michael, it all came down to the final ascent of the Mur de Huy. Talk us through the final 2 kilometers there.
Well, it's just, you know, simple, a lot of pain since you hit the last climb. You know, we know that it's quite big advantage for Bob Jungels, and he was amazing, by the way, riding solo for so many kilometers. Well, we looks like we had everything under control, and we just missed, you know, a bit of acceleration comparing to Alejandro. As he won, he did what he wanted, you know. So
happy with the team performance, all the same, and happy with yours?
Yeah, they were amazing, you know. We didn't control today because it was up to Movistar to take responsibility for chasing back the breakaway, but I mean, all the boys were amazing in the last loop and last important kilometers. We were there, so that's important. That's important, and I'm looking forward to Liège-Bastogne-Liège with such a great team.
What can we expect from you on Sunday then, Liège-Bastogne-Liège?
I mean, for sure we will be up there to fight for the victory as on Amstel as today, and I'm looking forward to the race. Let's hope with the good weather.
So that was Michał Kwiatkowski. No pronunciation police needed this week. His name is in safe hands with us, Orla. Well, as I wandered away from the finish and we saw a few people, we hoped to have a chat with Teo Gegenhardt making his debut. He just rode straight past us. Didn't stop.
He didn't. You yelled at him and it looked like he pedalled a little bit faster, to be fair.
I say, young man, stop. No, anyway, we'll catch up with him at some point.
He was probably a bit broken. That's a bit of a brutal race, really.
A baptism of fire. Yeah. I did speak to Samuel Sanchez, the Spanish rider on BMC team. Last time we saw him was a few weeks ago, or a couple of weeks ago, at the Basque Tour, where he had a horrendous crash on a downhill into a finish on the descent of, I think it was stage 4. Valverde won it, obviously. Set up his overall victory there, but Sanchez looked like he was going to win the stage. Came down very, very heavily indeed. I was surprised to see him back racing so soon. Here's what he had to say.
Yes, I'm fine, thanks. Today for me is a very important day, but I check my hand for the next races and good, more or less good.
You had surgery after the crash, did you?
Well, after the crash, I staying home 3-4 days, relax, no bike, only recovery. After 4 days, I start training, and more or less it's good.
You're okay. I mean, it was a really bad crash, and it looked like you had maybe had a stage wound there at the to the Basque Country.
Yeah. The stage is 95%. It's for me, you know, it's a terrible crash, and in a final 700K, and it's the cycling, it's the life. No, it's only look forward.
So today, not too many shocks to the system. You felt able to get into the rhythm of racing again today, did you?
Well, today, it's a difficult day for the wind, you know. In the final, Valverde is super strong, and it's the mountain of Valverde.
So Samuel Sanchez christening this Valverde Mountain. It is unusual to see a rider. I mean, we know he was coming here in such in as good a form as he's ever been in, and given his previous dominance, there was an inevitability about him winning here. But even as I watched them come up the lower slopes of the climb, Valverde looked easy. You know, it's just this is just a finish that suits his abilities down to the ground.
Yeah, and I wonder to what extent the rest of the riders kind of just accept. I'm reluctant to say it because they will all obviously say that they were all fighting for the win and whatnot, but when he joined that attack on the Murdoch, there seemed an almost acceptance that this was Valverde's race, and that is the vibe I sort of got from the other riders, that there's certainly no disappointment from any of them that they lost. They just, it was Valverde's race to take, really. I spoke to Serge Piles after the race. Nathan Haas was there, designated man for the day. A good showing at Amstel Gold, but just didn't really have the legs today. We'll hear from him in a little second, but every time I come to a race, I'm completely overwhelmed by, when you're watching at home on the sofa and you see these guys absolutely breaking themselves in the racing, I just can't quite get my head around how fresh they all look as soon as they've crossed the line, barring one or two here maybe on their knees. The rest of them, I mean, I'm chatting to Serge and he's barely out of breath and he looks like he's just been out for a Sunday morning poodle.
Maybe he didn't try hard enough.
Maybe that's why they didn't win.
He asked you about the podcast as well, I overheard.
He did, he was asking how the podcast was going. Must be a listener. Excellent. Hi, Serge. So I asked him about Nathan for today and the latest on Mark Cavendish and what the team are planning around his presence or otherwise at the Tour de France. Here's Serge Piles.
Well, today was actually a bit atypical because it was the whole day was pretty much headwind, and so the first 140K was not super hard, but then the final was pretty tough, and yeah, actually Movistar, they had everything under control, and it's not a surprise that Valverde wins in the end.
They changed the route this year. How did you find the parkour?
I think it was quite good because, the final was pretty tough, and I think that's actually what we wanted. But unfortunately, Nathan Haas was not having a good day, not the same day as last Sunday. So, yeah, we had all our hope on him, but unfortunately, I think he was not really up there.
And what about for Sunday then, Liège, Bastogne-Liège?
That's even a harder race. And we will give it our best shot again, and hopefully we can do a good result. I think we have got strength in numbers, but not a real leader for Sunday. So yeah, we'll see.
And how are things among the team? You've lost Mark Cavendish recently. Any rejigging of team plans, team schedules because of that?
Well, for the moment, we will have to wait what's going to happen. I mean, we hope he will recover by the Tour de France and be up there in a decent or good shape. And but yeah, for the moment, we don't know how far his disease is going to get him out of the races. So, yeah. We can only hope he's going to be back there in time.
So that was Serge Piles. Well, Orla, it's time for us to get off the mountain and drive north and homeward. We're homeward bound, hoping to get back tonight.
I'm not going to break into song. I nearly did there. We are. And just as we're leaving, it's been sunny all day, but it feels like the day has finally warmed up. I feel ready to shed some layers of thermals and we're just about to hop back into the car. But it's been a great day of racing. One that on paper might look a little bit on the dull side, given that the two overwhelming favourites emerged victorious. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a great, exciting day.
Well, I should plug our cycling podcast, Femina, which is coming out next week. And in that, we've got interviews with Anna van der Breggen, the winner today, Danny Stam, who runs Bulls Dolmans. We'll hear from Corin Rivera, the Women's World Tour leader, still the leader after today, we've found out. Who else is in that, Orla? We've got other people.
Luton as well.
Anna Meek van Vleuten. Megan Garnier.
Megan Garnier and Pauline Ferrand-Prévot.
Pauline Ferrand-Prévot. Yeah, we've got a long interview with her, which we did in the Canyon-SRAM team hotel last night. Interesting story. Not up there today. It wasn't a good day for Canyon-SRAM today. Disappointed faces around their team bus. But this is such a hard race and such an unforgiving race in that if you're not on top of it here, you're nowhere at all. And you know, the nature of the climb sort of accentuates those tiny differences in form and fitness. And as I said already, Valverde came here in superb form. There's no reason at all why he couldn't do what he's done the last 4 years. So Valverde wins. He will stop winning at some point,
you would think.
Here comes that crocodile in a BMC jersey again. Mistook that for a dragon earlier.
The crocodile that Richard thought was a dragon. Yeah.
Okay, well, it's time to go. Thanks very much for joining us on the regular podcast this week, Orla. Thanks to Lionel and Daniel for their contributions earlier on. And we'll return next week. Thank you, Orla.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.